I'm speaking today with Council Member Stephen Costello, who is the incumbent in at-large number one. Council Member Costello, thank you for talking to me today. You're in your second term now in council, and you know I understand that the first term is when people learn the job, and the second term is when they really start to get stuff done. How would you say the second term has been different for you?
I think you're right in terms of identifying what the first term is like. When I was an engineer, I was working for the city, I was working for parks, I was working for public works, I was working for planning, and I thought I knew the city. And there are 23 departments, and it takes quite a bit of time to get a better appreciation of all of the services that the city provides, not only in terms of public safety and infrastructure, but unique quality of life and public service to the community. So the first 2 years was enlightening for that. Fortunately, I had a very good staff. My chief of staff had worked for the city for years, and so that was very helpful. The second time around has been one where I've tried to focus on issues that I really cared about when I first got elected. Obviously, the first one was Rebuild Houston and the infrastructure program, and I continue to believe that it is a marquee program that we need to continue to communicate to the public the benefits of the program. I think by and large, the mistakes that we made, to be honest with you, looking back, was that we passed a funding program without a plan. And so we've been spending a lot of time developing the plan and the procedures for the plan. And then in today's world, the expectations are immediate, and yet the community doesn't realize that it takes time. The community doesn't realize that we have problems all over the city. So prioritizing worst first, everyone's worse. So how do you prioritize? So those are the challenges that we have. So I continue to be involved in that process. The other is bringing more of a fiscal responsibility to the city. We are charged with making sure that we spend the dollar carefully and properly. That was one of the surprises I had on being on council, was the general distrust of government. I didn't have that coming in, and I'm real surprised that it's very evident at large. And so I want to work on making sure that we're transparent, and the administration is very supportive of that. We have some significant financial challenges moving forward. Obviously, they're really employee-related, and that's pensions, that's health care. But on the non-employee-related aspect of the city that people don't really pay much attention to is that we have facilities that we own. We actually own over 420 buildings. We have all sorts of other facilities, pavilions, pools that the parks operate, and that we haven't done a good job of maintaining it like you or I would do as a house owner, of maintaining our facilities. And so it's a looming problem. We recently had a facilities assessment done that identified $1.6 billion of improvements that are required over the next 20 years, and yet we don't have a funding source identified. So those are some of the issues that I'm working on with the administration. If you look back at the budget we just passed, we set aside about $7 million for deferred maintenance, which is an oxymoron, deferred and maintenance. Maintenance is supposed to be occurring simultaneously. But it's a start. And what I hope to do, in fact, I brought it up on council today, is what I'd hope to do is to have a utilization study done, what I would call a space utilization study, because some of these buildings are not fully occupied. And maybe there's a way to consolidate our staff within these buildings, sell off that real estate, use the revenue from that real estate as a sinking fund for improving the facilities that we decide to keep. So those are some of the things I'm working on that aspect of it. Also, it's common knowledge that we have pension-related problems. I think the issue is one that we really can't avoid. We still have to have discussion about. And I'm not interested in talking about what caused the problem. I'm more interested in moving forward and recognizing the problem and moving forward. And I think that was evident at my Budget and Fiscal Affairs Committee meeting last Tuesday. I was absent. I was out. But most of my colleagues finally recognize that there is a problem. And that could be because of all the publicity about Detroit and Chicago. But they recognize that there is a problem. They want to make sure that we fulfill our commitment. And so what I hope to do over the next couple of months is to, assuming I get reelected, is to work with my colleagues to come up with some scenario planning and saying, okay, what if we meet our commitment, what does it do to the rest of the city? What does it do to the services that we provide? Are we prepared to scale back services? Are we prepared to scale back staff? Because when you have a budget of $1.92 billion and 80% of it is driven by personnel costs, whatever you decide to do is going to impact personnel. So there are some challenges there that we have. And then we have challenges with healthcare. They both go hand in hand. So those are the things I'm working on, I would say, would be the finance side of the city. The other side that I'm passionate about, which is some quality of life issues that I'm working on, one is food deserts. And people ask me, if there's anything that frustrates you about being a politician or being associated with the city, what would that be? And I tell them that the city moves glacially. And what you have to be, especially as a council member, is you have to be patient but persistent. And so we've been working on food deserts now for almost 3 years. And I've only been there a little over 3.5 years. And so it's a challenge. The challenges that we have are that we're trying to bring grocery stores into underserved areas. Well, there is a reason why the market has not provided grocery stores in those areas. And some of those are fairly substantial reasons. They could be the demographics of the area relative to density, average household income, and then crime issues. And so we're having to kind of peel back that onion and figure out how the city could maybe move the market a little bit. And what we've been able to do is we've been able to earmark some money that was HUD money that was earmarked for economic development, and we've been able to move that over to the Youth and Finance Corp, and it's money that's set aside now for food deserts to where we can work with a grocer, maybe give them a grant or maybe give them a very low interest loan to try to come into these areas. And so that's what we're working on. What I experienced, which I was real surprised about when I first started working on this, was I always felt like, well, these communities will just accept whatever we put out there because it's fresh food and it's grocers. And it was very surprising that the community has expectations. It's not just a grocery store. They want a specific grocery store because they have as much pride in their neighborhood as I have in my neighborhood. And they don't want, let's say, a very small independent operator. They want a fairly large, nationally recognized grocery store. And so there's
the accoutrements, like a pharmacy.
Correct.
And whatever
correct.
Else.
And they believe that their neighborhood could be the first step in redeveloping the neighborhood, which is why I believe in it. I believe that the resolution of food deserts has two components to it, and one is public safety, public health, and the other is economic development, because grocery stores are the first step in redeveloping an area. And so I value what the community says. It took me a little while to realize that. And then the other thing, in order for a food desert program to be successful, is that you have to have the community support, both not only in terms of the type of store you put there, but they have to also kind of embrace the store. And the way you do that, that's a two-way street. The way you do that is that you have the grocer hire from within the community. And, you know, that's how, I don't know if you knew this, but that's how I met my wife. She and I were teenagers working in a local grocery store. And so I see this as economic development for the community as well as jobs for the kids. And so that's how you get the community to accept and adopt the store.
Okay.
So I know you have some questions. I got one more issue. The other thing that I just started working on is payday lending and title lending.
I'm very interested in that.
And, you know, at first, when the topic first came across my desk, I really wasn't really that interested. I really wasn't paying attention to it very much. And then I started doing some research, and I'll tell you a personal story. My brother-in-law, who has struggled for many, many years, he lives in Atlanta, outside of Atlanta, called me, this was about 8 months ago, and said, listen, I just lost my car. I need some help. And historically, the family members have always helped him. And if I come to find out that he went through a title lender and ended up losing his car. And I felt like, well, you know, that's a problem that he had, but, you know, I'm here to help. Until I started doing some research into what these loans really are. And I was flabbergasted on how some of the industry people really take advantage of the people in need. And I think there's got to be a way for the city to regulate that. Now, that being said, we cannot regulate fees. So we have to, because that's federally regulated. So the only way we can regulate it is maybe through the number of loans that could be done, or the how the loan is structured relative to the percent of the percent of the lender's household income. So there are things that the city can do by a local ordinance. I've been dealing with Texas Appleseed. I've been dealing with AARP, and we hope to come up with something that could be maybe a compromise between something that the industry would accept and something that Dallas, Austin, and San Antonio and El Paso have that's in litigation, that maybe we can come up with something that might be acceptable to everybody. So that's what I decided to work on.
Okay. Well, that's good, because, you know, with the legislature's failure to act on payday lending, it really has come down to the cities. But let's talk briefly about Renew Houston, which now Rebuild Houston, since that was kind of your signature thing in your first term. Just give me a brief update. Where does it stand? What's going on with Rebuild Houston right now?
Actually, it's making tremendous progress. What people didn't realize when we passed Rebuild Houston was that our five-year CIP at the time in 2010, years 2012, 13, 14, were unfunded in terms of streets and drainage. All it said was future bond issues. And so what we were doing in the past was every 5 or 6 years, we would sell $500 or $600 million in bonds to do street and drainage projects. And yet our need was getting bigger and bigger and bigger. I mean, there was a study done in somewhere around 2005 that showed that we had a $5 billion problem in drainage alone. And yet we were investing less than $100 million every year. And so what we did was we decided to come up with a revenue-generating source, which is a drainage user fee that we all pay, as well as a conversion of debt financing to pay-as-you-go. Now, over the life of the 20-year program, the conversion of debt to pay-as-you-go will end up being about 40 to 50% of the total funds raised over the 20-year period. But initially, the drainage user fee is going to be the lion's share of the money raised. So what's happening is that we're only spending about $180 million right now to $250 million. And that's a combination of our drainage user fee and the money we get from Metro from the rebate and the sales tax. So when we passed it, I visited with the mayor and I told the mayor, I said, you know, mayor, this is your marquee program and my marquee program, but as a mayor, you're not going to realize the benefit because the lion's share of the money is going to show up in the out years, which would be years 8 through 12, and then from 12 out to 20. And so so that's the problem we're having. So what we've been investing in right now is developing a program that will identify projects on a needs-based, and then go ahead and ranking projects, and then building as much as we can with the money that we have every year until more money comes in at the out years. What we haven't done a good job of doing is telling the community where we are on the program and what we're doing and where the money's going. Because there's these allegations that we are moving people into the program, taking care of overhead. Well, those same people were doing the capital projects and the maintenance on streets and drainage before. So all we did was take it from the capital improvement side and just put it in Rebuild Houston. What we did when we passed the charter amendment was we wanted to rebuild the city. The engineering community said we need to rebuild our city. So we put some caveat around the program and said, okay, whatever dollars you raise, only 25% of it can be used for maintenance. The balance is to be used for construction. So the people that were doing maintenance before are in this program, but they're still getting their funding through the same dollar route, but it's bracketed by 25%. So I'm happy with the program. I'm not happy with the lack of communication. And I've reached out to the administration. They've hired a couple of people on staff to help with what I would call social media, Twitter, Facebook, and just trying to get the message out. But it's going to take us time. It really is.
Now, let's talk about the financials, though. I mean, when everyone talks about the city's long-term finances, pensions is what they talk about first, and then health care sometimes comes up and sometimes doesn't, though it was just in the news last week. But with pensions, the city has some control over the municipal and police pensions. It's the firefighter's pension that is the most contentious because the city does not have meet and confer with the firefighters. But as you know, I mean, ultimately, as you yourself just said earlier in this interview, any changes you make, they're going to affect people. Make them contribute more, pay them out less, whatever it is, it's going to directly affect the people. So what is your ideal solution to the pension problem as you see it? You know, if you could say, this is where I want us to be, at the end of, this is where I want us to be to say it's solved, what does that look like to you?
Okay. To set more of the foundation of where we're at. Prior to 2001, the cost of pension was between 15 and 18% of salary cost of payroll. And that is a defined benefit plan that's very, very affordable. As a result of benefit changes in 2003, 2004, now our liability is varying anywhere between 25%, projected to be almost as much as 45% of payroll, which is not sustainable. So my thought process is, and where we are in terms of the unfunded liability, is really that we're almost $2.5 to $3 billion of unfunded liability. And it's a combination of increase in benefits, the city not paying their actuarial required contribution, and the returns on the funds, because we guarantee an 8.5% return. Okay, that's where we are today. Moving forward, probably what needs to be done is probably a compromise between both the defined benefit plan and the city's contribution. So here's what we need to do. Because we have a pension reform that's already been done by the municipal employees for anyone that's been hired post-2008, and what has already been done for police of anyone hired post-2004, there is light at the end of the tunnel. Basically, the active employees that were hired prior to those dates have to go through the system, and then you have fire. So there is a hump that we have to overcome to get to the light at the end of the tunnel. What I think we ought to do is the pension reform I recommend would be to either get rid of automatic cost of living adjustments or to negotiate to where we give cost of living adjustments when the city has the ability to pay. And then get rid of what is called the Deferred Retirement Option Plan, which is the DROP program. Those are unique benefits that are both there for the existing participants as well as for all firefighters coming in right now. If we get rid of those two, we solve the unfunded liability aspect of the program over a 30-year period. And then what we should do as a city is commit that we will pay the actuarial required contribution annually. Because what we have done is, as a result of meet and confer, is that we've negotiated with these unions, with the pension boards, saying that we can't make the ARC payment, A-R-C. So can we make one less, and then we'll pay you in the future? So we have created the problem by meeting confer to make a lesser payment. And if you look at what is projected based on the current contracts we have with all three pension boards, we are projected in 2019 to meet the ARC payment for municipal. We are projected to be about 95% of the ARC payment for police in 2019 as well. And we meet the ARC payment right now for fire because the state mandated. But just meeting the payment doesn't mean anything. From here to 2019, we're going to underfund it by almost $400 million anyway. See what I'm saying? So we're just not making the payment. And then you have the issue of guaranteeing the return on investment. And the city is saying we're going to guarantee that the investment makes an 8.5% return.
But hasn't it historically done that outside of,
Well, outside of 2008 and 2009, if you look back at historical records, they've averaged about that. When I've talked to the consultant that represents the city on all three boards, he has indicated over the last 5 years it's been slightly less. So the real question is do we agree to 8.5%? Do we go to maybe something like 7%? You know, those are things that I think can negotiate. But the big change would be the city's commitment to make the ARC payment with the pension boards agreeing to a COLA and getting rid of the drop. That's probably the best thing we can do without letting anybody go.
Okay. It always seems like when we talk about the city's finances, we're mostly talking about expenditures. Does the city adequately fund itself? I mean, during the time of Mayor Bill White, we had a number of property tax reductions. You know, they were small, but you know, you figure that's got to be a million here, a million there. Over time, it adds up. Does the city adequately fund itself?
Well, to answer that question, I think you have to answer the first question. And the first question is, with the resources that the city has right now, are they spending their dollar wisely? And one might say, maybe not, because of our liabilities, because of pension issues, because of health care. Because if you look at our health care business model, even though we're self-insured, compared to the private sector, our health care plan is a very robust plan. And so one in the business community might look at the city and say, well, until you change those types of benefits, I'm not convinced you're spending your money wisely. And when you have a budget that is dominated by 65%, which is police and fire, which is public safety, which to me is mandatory. You have to make sure you have a safe community before you can do anything else. You know, those are issues that you can say. So let's assume that the assumption is that we are spending our money wisely. So then the real question is are we raising enough revenue to provide the services that the community wants? And my answer to that is no. And my answer to that is that we should never have lowered property taxes for the sake of lowering property taxes. Because we have so much resource, we have so much demand on our services right now, it's evident by looking at the need for Rebuild Houston. The streets and drainage systems are in deplorable condition. Our facilities now, we have a huge $1.6 billion problem in our facilities. You can go down the list on some of the problems that we have, and that's due to lack of resources. So I think that's the way you have to approach it. However, now that being said, as a politician, who's going to get reelected or elected saying, I'm going to raise your taxes? And so you have to... Number one, you have to help inform the public of the need. And if we can overcome the distrust, maybe we can accomplish that by saying, well, we're going to have to raise property taxes. But I think there's a better way to do that in just generally saying raising property taxes. It's common knowledge that we have issues related to the valuation of commercial properties. And that's regulated by the state.
I was going to say, as with pension, that tends to be more of a legislative issue.
Right. And so, you know, that's in a route that we can take to pursue increased revenues on the property tax side. You know, our primary sources of revenue is property taxes, sales tax revenue, and permits and fees and licenses. And, you know, we have done over the past 3 years taken steps to raise our fees to match the costs of providing that service. So I'm okay with that. I would like to pursue the valuation aspect through the state. That's an uphill battle, and let me tell you why it's an uphill battle. One of the things that surprised me most being on city council is the lack of coordination of our state delegation. You know, whether we are from the right or from the left, we're really all Houstonians. And I find it troubling that the largest city in the state, fourth largest city in the country, cannot have a coalesced legislative group that could work on our behalf in Austin. And I'm really puzzled about that. And I don't know if it's a fault of this administration, the other administrations, or the fact that we have such polarized right and left now. But I still think that we should continue to reach out and help get them to help us. What I think is great is what Mayor Parker has been doing lately with the county, in doing projects jointly with the county, and that's something that we historically have always had problems with. So I think people are beginning to see the benefit of the city reaching out for other agencies to work together with us.
Okay. Let's go on to some other issues here. Let's talk about food trucks for a minute, because, you know, Houston has developed a reputation as a great food city, and food trucks have been a big part of that. And as you know, council had some hearings a little while ago about allowing food trucks to operate downtown, where they're currently not allowed to operate. The food truck people are organizing in favor of that. Is that something you favor, allowing food, changing city requirements, ordinances, whatever it takes, to allow food truck vendors to operate downtown?
I was in the middle of that in talking a little bit about the challenges that we have with the food truck industry impacting the brick and mortar industry in the tunnel system. And you and I both know that the food service groups in the tunnel system really just provide breakfast and lunch. I mean, nobody goes down in the tunnels during dinner time.
They're almost all closed by 3 o'clock.
And so the food truck obviously is going to be challenging that. I thought the issue relative to the fire marshal and all that other stuff was really sort of kind of a cloud over really what the issue is. I thought we had a compromise relative to allowing the food trucks to operate downtown, provided they're on private property that the property owner has agreed to let them do that, and that they don't provide tables and chairs. And I thought that was the latest compromise. I haven't heard since then. But I'm supportive of incubator businesses, because, in fact, the food truck industry came and talked to me about that. And they said, you know, we're really an incubator business. You know, nobody can make a living on a food truck. But what they do is this is a way for them to get into the food industry, get to know business.
And quite a few of them have since opened restaurants.
And quite a few have since opened brick-and-mortar businesses, which is what we really want. So I'm in favor of the food trucks. I do want to recognize that they're the brick-and-mortar business as well, and I know that there's something that we can come up with that would be beneficial for everybody.
Okay. In 2001, there was a charter amendment passed in the city of Houston that forbade it from offering domestic partner benefits to its employees. As you know, and the country's kind of changed some since then. The Supreme Court ruling on the Defense of Marriage Act, it's a federal thing, but still, the public opinion has largely shifted. A number of Texas cities are now offering domestic partner benefits to its employees. Would you favor changing that charter amendment, or if a movement came to change that, would you be supportive of it?
Not only be supportive, I would actually carry that, because I truly believe that it's essential that we provide partner benefits. And it's disappointing as a businessman to see that we are isolating a group of residents and a group of people that is unfairly isolated. I believe people should be happy with one another, and I think we should provide partner benefits.
Okay. And I'm asking everybody this question: who are you supporting for mayor?
Well, that's probably a silly question for me. I mean, I'm the administration's chair of budget and fiscal affairs. I'm actually going to support this mayor. I think Mayor Parker, in my lifetime here at the city, and particularly as a businessman, has probably been the best mayor we've ever had in terms of infrastructure development, in terms of quality of life, just in terms of managing the city. And I really believe that she's done a great job, and I'm fully supportive of the mayor.
Okay. And as we sit here and talk today, as far as I know, nobody has filed a run against you, but the deadline is still a little ways away. When people go to vote this November, whether you have an opponent or not, why should people vote to give you a third term on city council?
Well, I still have some issues I want to work on. I believe that, in fact, I'm working on redrafting up the entire financial policy for the city and the budget process. And I still want to get some food desert projects done, and I want to get this payday lending issue resolved. So even though I don't have an opponent right now, I'm still campaigning. I'm still reaching out to all the groups to ask for their support, and I've been pleased and the fact that I'm getting quite a bit of support from people that have supported me in the past, and I just ask everyone to continue to support my efforts.
All right. Councilmember Stephen Costello, thank you very much for talking to me today.
Great. Sorry I got a little winded.